Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute this evening with our speaker, Dr. Lavina Lee. I'll introduce her briefly. She worked in consultancy. She did a research work at the Chatham House in London, and she's currently lecturer in politics and international relations at Macquarie University. In recent times, she has a grant from Macquarie University to study the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement and its relationship to Australia. And in recent times, she's just published a book with Routledge titled US Hegemony and Legitimacy, Norms, Power and Followership in the War in Iraq. If you want a copy, Anne can give you information.
It's expensive.
What it really should be called is US Policy in Iraq, I think is the non-academic way of saying it. Okay. And Dr. Lee is going to speak for us tonight on her speciality, or one of her specialities, which is why Australia should sell uranium to India. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Jared and Anne for the opportunity to speak here at the Sydney Institute. Now, tonight I'm going to be speaking about what I believe to be a central issue holding back a deepening of the strategic and economic relationship between Australia and India. The decision, basically, by the Rudd government in January of 2008 to reverse the Howard government's recent policy towards the end of its tenure, to begin selling uranium to India. Now, I must say at the outset, it's not my intention at all to speak about whether Australia itself should have a nuclear power generating capacity. That's not my interest tonight. It's purely about the Australia-India relationship. Now, Australia is a country with an abundant natural resources in uranium. According to the World Nuclear Association, in 2007, Australia had the world's largest known deposits of low-cost uranium, with about 23% of the world's low-cost uranium, followed by Kazakhstan and Russia, who had 15% and 10%, respectively. Now, we've been exporting uranium for some time to both recognised nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, with our major buyers being the United States, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and more recently China from 2006 onwards. In the year 2008 to 2009, around 10,000 tonnes of uranium oxide concentrate were exported with a value of about $1 billion Australian dollars. In terms of Australia's uranium export policy, the Labor Party has long been guided in its uranium export policy by concerns about the proliferation of nuclear weapons technology. When in power, it has taken an active role in international diplomacy over the development of things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty, the establishment of the Canberra Commission, and the creation of the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, which is co-chaired by Australia and Japan. Now, whilst the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have in the past disagreed about how many uranium mines Australia should have and how much uranium we should export, both parties have been in agreement about the need to ensure that Australian uranium ore, if it's exported, is only used for peaceful purposes. With this in mind, Australia's uranium export policy therefore includes the following conditions. One, that uranium may only be exported for peaceful non-explosive purposes under a network of bilateral safeguards agreements, which provide for, I quote, coverage of uranium exports by IAEA safeguards from the time they leave Australian ownership, and continuation of coverage by IAEA safeguards for the full life of that material or until it is legitimately removed from safeguards. Further, Australia will not export uranium to any country that is not a party of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And any customer that is a non-nuclear weapon state must have also concluded a full-scope safeguards agreement with the IAEA, including the signing of an additional protocol. Under these conditions, the sale of uranium to India is precluded because it is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, since the Rudd government made the announcement about its change of policy on India, on the sale of uranium to India, there's been two major developments that have taken place. Firstly, the approval by the US Congress of a bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement between the United States and India in October of 2008. And secondly, the issue of a waiver by the Nuclear Suppliers Group allowing trade in civilian technologies and materials by its members with India on the 6th of September 2008. It should be noted that the Nuclear Suppliers Group is a consensus body and that Australia, as a part of the NSG, also agreed to the granting of this waiver to India. As such, the NSG effectively agreed to recognise India's status as a de facto nuclear weapons state. Now, despite its support for the waiver to India at the NSG, on his visit to India in November 2009, Prime Minister Rudd reiterated government policy to bar uranium exports to that country. At the same time, he acknowledged, I quote, India is a fundamentally important relationship for Australia. It is so strategically, it is so economically. Now, Mr. Rudd noted that in past decades, the relationship with India had been on again and off again, and hopes to rectify that situation. Now, what I'm about to argue is that Australia's stance on exports of uranium to India is now an outdated policy. It serves no real non-proliferation purpose. It is counterproductive to our stated climate change mitigation aims, and it stands in the way of real recognition of India's importance to Australia strategically and economically, and therefore it should be reversed. Now, firstly, I argue that the Labor Party's policy on uranium sales to India is now out of step with outside events and serves no further non-proliferation purpose. Now, as a result of the two events I've just mentioned, the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement and the NSG waiver, India is now viewed as a de facto nuclear weapon state, despite not having joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. By refusing to sell uranium to India, Australia now stands alone in pursuing an outdated strategy to bring India into the NPT. And I'd like to briefly just talk about what that previous strategy was. The non-proliferation regime has long followed a policy of isolation in regard to those states that have remained outside the NPT, that have refused to join it, including India, Pakistan, and now North Korea. Since its first peaceful nuclear explosion in 1974, India has been unable to access nuclear technology and materials through trade. The NSG itself was created at the instigation of the United States as a response to these 1974 peaceful nuclear explosions, to coordinate export controls on nuclear trade, to prevent transfers of civilian nuclear technology and material from being diverted to military purposes. India has never joined the NPT on the grounds that it is an inherently discriminatory regime that does not compel nuclear weapon states to disarm, whilst requiring non-nuclear weapon states from seeking their own weapons capabilities. Now, whilst India is not a nuclear weapon state or a non-nuclear weapon state, as it is not, it has never joined the NPT. The NSG barred civilian trade with it and all other states that were non-party to that treaty, the NPT, on the grounds that, I quote, non-parties should not be given the same assistance as those that had joined the treaty. That is, the non-proliferation regime sought to isolate those countries outside the NPT from nuclear trade to provide them with an essential incentive to join and to reward those non-nuclear weapon states within the treaty for their nuclear abstinence. Now, despite this strategy of isolation, during this period, India has developed a truly indigenous nuclear program, both in a civilian and a military capacity. This includes a fleet of advanced heavy water pressurized reactors, as well as a reprocessing and enrichment capability. This has largely come about for two main imperatives. One, a desire for greater energy security through nuclear power, as well as for military security as a defence against nuclear coercion from its neighbours, Pakistan and China, with whom it has fought previous military conflicts in the past. The US-India agreement and the NSG waiver represents an abandonment of the strategy of isolation against India and an acceptance of the fact that India will never sign the NPT if it first requires the destruction of its nuclear arsenal. India's strategic insecurities essentially preclude it from doing so without the disarmament at the same time of its neighbours, Pakistan and China. Now, the abandonment of this strategy by the NSG stems from the view that more can be achieved by bringing India into the wider non-proliferation regime by requiring it to abide by things like NSG export controls and missile technology control regime guidelines, by requiring it to separate its civilian and military nuclear programs and to place the former under IAEA safeguards, which it has agreed to do. By sticking to a policy based on an outdated state of affairs, despite supporting the NSG waiver, the Australian government cannot alone achieve any non-proliferation benefits. India is now free to trade in civilian nuclear technologies and materials with any other NSG member. Now, I'd like to also argue that the sale of uranium to India would support the non-proliferation treaty rather than undermine it. It has been argued by the arms control community that the NSG waiver rewards India for staying outside the non-proliferation treaty and developing a military program. They argue that the lesson that may be learned from the Indian case is that ultimately there are no consequences for the development of a nuclear weapons program, which, once acquired, is considered a fact that the international community has no choice but to accept. This, they argue, may encourage other non-nuclear weapon states to withdraw from the treaty. Now, what I argue is that the sale of uranium should not be viewed as, in fact, rewarding India for staying outside the nuclear weapons, the non-proliferation treaty. Rather, it should be seen as a reward for showing restraint in its nuclear policies and for its adherence to non-proliferation norms, despite not being a member of the NPT. India can be regarded as a responsible nuclear power because it has never spread its homegrown nuclear weapons technology to any other state, unlike China, who is a member of the NPT and has been linked to proliferation to Pakistan. It has maintained a voluntary moratorium on nuclear testing since 1998. It has declared no first use policy in regards to its nuclear arsenal, and it has a minimum credible deterrent policy in regard to the size of this arsenal. For these reasons, it should not be put in the same deviant category as other non-nuclear proliferation treaty states such as North Korea and Pakistan. The NSG has also agreed to consult on the issue of a withdrawal of the waiver should India conduct a nuclear weapons test again. As a result,
the Indian government would have a strong interest in abstaining from testing again to avoid jeopardising its access to international trade in civilian nuclear technologies and material, both of which is necessary to underpin its stated ambition to expand this nuclear power capacity exponentially. I would like to also now briefly address the argument that the sale of uranium to India would indirectly allow its reserve of its domestic uranium resources to be reserved for its military program. Now, this is technically possible. Whilst India was subject to NSG controls, that is prior to 2008, both its civilian and military program were restricted by the limitations of its natural uranium ore reserves, which are small and of poor quality. India, as a result of the NSG agreement and the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, has agreed to separate its civilian and military programs, but it has not agreed to cap its fissile material production. So technically it is possible for India to reserve its domestic sources of uranium for its military program. Now, one, I would say, however, that from Australia's point of view, the same objections would apply to our uranium sales to China. There is no, at this stage, no agreed fissile material cut-off treaty. In my view, in assessing the likelihood of India now accelerating its military program and the size of its strategic arsenal, we should keep in mind its past policies of nuclear restraint. There has been no change to its policy of seeking a minimum credible deterrent, which is estimated to fall somewhere between 100 and 150 nuclear warheads at most. It does not seek parity with China, which has about 400 nuclear warheads. It only needs to ensure that it has a sufficient number of nuclear warheads and adequate delivery systems to ensure a second strike capability. Economically also, India is still far behind China in terms of the size of its economy, and it cannot compete in a nuclear arms race from that basis. The problems of poverty alleviation and economic growth are of much greater priority. Now, if there are no longer any non-proliferation benefits to be had by refusing to sell uranium to India, then I argue that Australia is unnecessarily missing out on a number of economic, climate change mitigation, and strategic benefits that could arise from a reversal of this policy. Australia, in terms of economic benefits, Australia is unnecessarily missing out on economic opportunities that have arisen as a result of the NSG waiver. India has announced plans to exponentially expand the contribution of nuclear power to its energy mix. The government of India aims to continue a 8-9% growth target to bring greater numbers of its population out of poverty. In 2006, the Indian Planning Commission estimated, I quote, "With the population growing at 1.5% per annum, 9% growth in GDP would double real per capita income in 10 years. So from the Indian government's perspective, it is essential to maintain this 8-9% level of economic growth. India still has a significant proportion of its population living in poverty, with around 28% of the rural population and 26% of the urban population still living below the poverty line. There is also a strong connection between economic growth and energy security. The Indian Planning Commission has estimated that to sustain an 8% growth rate up to 2031, to 2032, the country needs to expand its electricity capacity by 5 times over the next 20 years. Now, in order to achieve this target, the government plans a massive expansion of nuclear power. There are varying estimates on the size of this growth, with one report stating that the government plans to expand nuclear power capacity from around 4,000 megawatts to around 50,000 megawatts by 2040. Whilst another report cites a statement by Sri Kumar Banerjee, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, as estimating that nuclear power generation will increase to 60,000 megawatts by 2035. So that's a real massive expansion in nuclear power. Now, India does not have sufficient indigenous sources of uranium to fuel this expansion, unless its ambitious fast breeder program is successful. The Department of Atomic Energy has estimated that indigenous uranium resources can sustain the production of 10,000 megawatts per year for 40 years, passed through pressurized heavy water reactors. If the fast breeder program fails to materialise, the expansion of nuclear power will require the import of a substantial amount of uranium. The reality is that if Australia continues to refuse to sell uranium to India, it will be able to meet its requirements through trade with other countries. States such as France, Russia and Kazakhstan have wasted no time in setting up deals to export nuclear reactors and material already. On the uranium front, while Australia has the largest uranium deposits in the world and the largest low-cost deposits of uranium, states such as Kazakhstan, Mongolia and Russia have already stepped in to fill the breach, while Canada is already keen to sign a nuclear cooperation agreement with India and is apparently in the closing stages of signing a deal. So as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this talk, Kazakhstan has the second largest low-cost reserves of uranium ore after Australia, and it has already signed a deal with India. Apart from the economic opportunities foregone, uranium sales will also support the Australian government's climate change objectives. It's well known that the economic growth of the two most populous nations in the world, China and India, into the next century will contribute to a vast increase in greenhouse gas emissions, unless there are significant breakthroughs in renewable and other clean technologies. Nuclear power is, of course, almost carbon neutral, emitting between 9 to 100 grams per kilowatt hour of carbon dioxide, compared to 800 to 860 grams per kilowatt hour from advanced coal. India cannot avoid using coal to fuel economic growth into the future, with coal being its most abundant natural resource. It has been estimated, for example, that India's consumption of the world's coal will rise from 6% to 45% by the middle of this century. Nuclear power, however, can reduce the climate change impact of this growth by reducing the amount of coal used to provide electricity. In testimony given before the US Senate in 2006, the academic Professor David Victor estimated that the displacement of 20,000 megawatt E produced by coal-powered fire stations would abate around 145 million tonnes of CO2 per year. So if you remember what I said a little while ago, that India plans to expand its nuclear power capacity by about 40,000 megawatts. David Victor is saying 20,000 megawatts would abate around 145 million tonnes of CO2 per year. Now, he estimated that even a 20,000 megawatt E provided by nuclear power represented, I quote, "the entire commitment of the 25 EU nations to reducing emissions under the Kyoto Protocol, and exceeds the total carbon savings from the 100 largest developing country projects under the Kyoto Protocol's Clean Development Mechanism." Now, if India manages to expand its nuclear power generation capacity to 40,000 megawatts, this would therefore abate around 390 million tonnes of CO2 per year. And to put this in context, for example, in Australia in 2006, our total carbon emissions were 417 metric tonnes of CO2. Now, lastly, I'd like to talk about the strategic benefits of changing this policy. I believe that the issue of uranium sales has become the central roadblock to a deepening of the strategic relationship between the two countries. Australia is very keen to build closer defence ties with New Delhi, a trend which began with the previous Howard government, with initiatives including Australia's participation, along with Japan and Singapore, in the Malabar naval exercises conducted by the US and Indian navies in the Bay of Bengal in September of 2007. Similarly, on his visit to India in October of 2009, Foreign Minister Stephen Smith put in a request with his counterpart, S.M. Krishna, to again participate in the Malabar exercises, and also invited India to participate in multilateral Australian Defence Force-hosted exercises in Kakadu and Pitch Black. To my knowledge, India has not yet acceded to this request. Both Australia and India share security interests in maintaining maritime security in the Indian Ocean and share an apprehension about the implications of a rising China. Australia's recent defence white paper makes clear that China's rising power, its military modernisation and projection capabilities have an unknown strategic purpose. It is in Australia and India's interest to expand our naval cooperation in the Indian Ocean to provide a check on possible Chinese ambitions there. Whilst there are signs that both countries recognise their similar strategic interests, particularly the issue of the Australia-India, particularly in relation to the issue of a India-Australia joint declaration on security cooperation in November 2009, which includes defence cooperation on issues like terrorism and maritime and aviation security, this initiative so far, in its early days, has not been fleshed out. It is likely that whilst the uranium issue remains outstanding, genuine strategic cooperation will not be forthcoming. The Indian government will likely come under strong pressure from its strategic elites to slow progress on this front until the matter is resolved. From an Indian perspective, the refusal to sell uranium demonstrates a lack of trust in India's own strategic ambitions within the region. Thank you.
Many thanks. Now, as was pointed out, if anyone wants a copy of U.S. Hegemony, Legitimacy, Norms, Power and Fellowship in the War on Iraq, let us know, because we can get copies from the publisher and supply them to you. It's an important work and it's an important topic. So now we come to questions and discussion. Just to take on from where you finished your talk, when Ann and I were in India at the towards the end of 2008, talking to senior people in government, there seemed to be a great degree of intensity, a feeling about Australia's decision not to sell uranium. Do you pick that up in your visits to India, and what's the level of intensity?
Well, I was in India in October last year, 2009, and I spoke to probably about 15 or so people from the strategic community within India. And other than the issue of Indian students and racism in Australia, the second major issue was, why isn't Australia selling uranium to us? We don't understand it. Why is Australia the one lone holdout out of all of the other kind of possible strategic partners in the region? Particularly given that the NSG waiver has been granted and that India can in fact trade with any other country that it wants that has nuclear weapons technology and that's a member of the NSG. they can't understand why Australia won't abandon that. And I did pick up strongly that it seems like a nonsensical policy that they can't understand, and therefore they wonder whether then it's in India's own interest to progress a further strategic relationship with Australia, or a deeper one, in other words.
Anya.
It's right, isn't it, that the non-proliferation treaty is due to be renegotiated soon. So could that present an opportunity for a change in India's status, and should Australia be taking it upon itself to lobby for a change, or could we have any influence in that process?
When you say a change in the status, what do you mean?
Could it be recognised under a new NPT as a nuclear weapons power?
I think
repeat that question.
Sure. I think, is it Anya? Yeah. Anya is asking whether there's a 2010 review conference for the Non-Proliferation Treaty this year, and Anya is asking whether this provides an opportunity for India to become accepted within the treaty as a nuclear weapons state. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Essentially? Look, I don't think that's a likely possibility. I don't think the members of the NPT don't want to make exceptions officially within the treaty itself. And they have pretty much stated that they will allow India to join the NPT only on the condition that it actually joins as a non-nuclear weapon state, not as a nuclear weapon state. And India will not give up its nuclear weapons. It has strong interests still in keeping its nuclear weapons arsenal for defensive purposes. So I guess the patch job that's been done, the NSG and the US-India Cooperation Agreement, is that we have to deal with the reality of India not joining the NPT, and because it has displayed responsible behaviour in the past, that it is, I guess, deserving of being treated as a nuclear weapon state without officially joining. Now, this doesn't mean that the international community isn't trying to draw India into non-proliferation norms. It's trying to encourage India, and India's quite receptive to the signing of a comprehensive test ban treaty and the fissile material cutoff treaty, for example. And India has also agreed to conform its missile technology controls and its non-proliferation export controls to accord with the same types of controls as other NSG members. Sorry, hope I've answered your question.
Yeah. Question here, then we go down the back. Yeah.
Tell me, why do people in India think that the Australian decision has something to do with not trusting India? Because the reason from an Australian perspective has nothing to do with India. It has everything to do with Australian support. We signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty under a coalition government and ratified it under a Labor government. It's been consensus politics in Australia for 40 years or more. And it has nothing to do with India. It's because of our very strong support for the non-proliferation regime and the feeling that the United States has all manner of weapons in its kit bag, diplomatically speaking. We only have one in this context, and that is our uranium, to try and strengthen, preserve, and if possible, grow the non-proliferation regime. This is the only card we've got to play, and we're playing it with everybody. If we only had an exception for India, what could we say to the Iranians and the North Koreans and others?
Well, look, first I'd say that Australia has agreed to sell uranium, for example, to China, and it does, from 2006. And yes, it is a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but you would also say that China doesn't in a lot of ways have as good a non-proliferation record as India does, even though India is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So in selling uranium to China, we don't require China to stop producing fissile material. So we put conditions on what the uranium that we sell them can be used for, but we don't preclude them from using their own uranium to reserve that for their military program and to build up their own strategic arsenal. So I think what India is saying is that you treat China in one way, and you treat us in another way because we don't sign the NPT. But India has never signed the NPT. It's not actually technically breaking any of its international agreements. It's never promised to make any of those agreements. So I think if you're looking at it from a purely what is the purpose of this policy, the purpose of the policy is to prevent proliferation, you've got to ask yourself the question, is it actually serving the purpose anymore? Now, in terms of North Korea, you mentioned North Korea. What does it say to countries like North Korea? I think what I argued in my talk was that what it's saying is that it's not rewarding India for staying outside the NPT. It's rewarding India for actually showing restraint in its nuclear policies over 30 years. It hasn't proliferated. It hasn't sought to expand its nuclear arsenal to a sizable extent. It has been very restrained. It has a no first use policy. It has a moratorium on testing. So it is a restrained nuclear power, and what these countries should learn from it is that if you similarly are responsible with nuclear technology, then you too could be rewarded.
As you know, Canada is an ally of Australia, so how's Canada getting around this problem?
Well, I think with Canada, Canada's taking the same pragmatic view as everybody else in the NSG, that India is a responsible power, and it's never going to sign the NPT. It too will have the same kind of safeguards as what Australia would like to apply. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we should treat India like any other nuclear weapon state that we trade uranium with. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a bilateral safeguards agreement, that we shouldn't have a strict separation between the civilian and military sides of their program, and ensure that only the uranium is only used in the civilian program. And we can do that. India, in its cooperation agreement with the United States, has agreed to separate between its civilian and military programs and to put the civilian program under IAEA safeguards and to assign an additional protocol. So we can be quite assured that any uranium that we send to India can be put under safeguards and be used only for the civilian program and not the military program.
There's a question right down the back. John, yes.
Look, I'd actually say that Pakistan has already tried to go down the India route. Pakistan has already requested the NSG to also grant it a waiver, and the NSG has refused it. And the NSG has refused it on the grounds that it has a poor non-proliferation record. So they can point to the AQ Khan network and the fact that Pakistan has proliferated to other so-called rogue states around the world. And it's very explicit about that, that it is about its record. And it's saying that India's waiver is granted because of its good record. So India, you know, India doesn't have to say very much because the rest of the NSG, I think, is in agreement that it's not necessarily a good idea to give the same kind of waiver to Pakistan.
So there's a question here, then we go down the back, yep.
As a geologist, I was interested in the uranium resource, but you answered the question, you know.
Yeah.
Because about 30 years ago, I just missed out on an exploration job to do, to look for oil deposits in India. So I have a social political question. Here in Australia, you have groups opposing and using the phrase, you know, not in my backyard, when it comes to building, electricity generation based on uranium. Do you have similar groups? Are they allowed in India to oppose energy, you know, based on uranium?
Okay. At the moment, there's a bill that's come before the Parliament, or is going to be put before the Parliament, about civil liability for nuclear accidents. Now, up till this point, there's been actually very little resistance within the Indian population to the government's expansion plans in nuclear power. I think that Indian people understand that if they're going to maintain an 8-9% growth rate, they have to expand their electricity capacity about 5 times. And if we've got climate change as a consideration as well, how is this going to occur? Up until this point, I think the middle classes in India have been very receptive to this idea that nuclear power could be the kind of silver bullet that will allow growth to continue and spread throughout the society. But I would say that in the next, say, 6 months, when this bill goes to Parliament, there are plans for nuclear activist groups to try and oppose the spread of this expansion, not so much on the basis that that they're against the expansion of electricity capacity, but they're worried about nuclear accidents and whether there will be sufficient monies reserved to compensate, because India was the site of one of the major disasters, the Bhopal incident, so there's a lot of concern about that.
Go up here.
This is really a follow-up question to the Pakistan question.
Yeah.
Yep. And you discussed this in terms of the strategic balance between India and China,
yep,
but didn't discuss this in terms of the strategic balance between India and Pakistan.
Yep.
So my question really is, if there were to be, if Australia were to sell uranium to India, if there were to be a strategic balance,
yep,
change between India and Pakistan as a result of that, and that's a big question anyway,
yep.
But assuming that there would be a change, but then leaping into the importance, if you like, of nuclear power for electricity generation in India, which is in Australia's greatest interest to prevent any hypothetical change in balance between India and Pakistan, or to facilitate greater generation of electricity?
Okay, all right. I can kind of answer this in a few ways. Firstly, it doesn't really matter whether Australia sells uranium to India. From India's perspective, it can get it from somewhere else. So in that sense, Australia is denying itself some real economic and climate change benefits. The argument has been raised, I think I did speak a little bit about it, that with the NSG waiver, so let's take it away from Australia, with the NSG waiver, India can reserve its domestic sources of uranium purely for its weapons program. And there's nothing to stop it from doing that. It hasn't been asked to stop producing fissile material. Now, my response would be that it's always a possibility. It hasn't happened so far in the sense that India is making all the right statements about nuclear restraint, in that it is saying that it might seem odd to us from this perspective, but when you go to India, Indians seem to be much more worried about China and not so worried about Pakistan, even though we see more tensions with Pakistan than we ever see with China. So from India's perspective, India will always have an advantage over Pakistan. And in a sense, it's an asymmetrical relationship between the three. Pakistan's never going to equalise with India. India will not be able to equalise with China. So potentially, it could increase its nuclear arsenal. But from what it is saying is that it is showing restraint. It understands that there's a potential for causing other states to become alarmed if it does so. And I'd also say that even without this NSG waiver, say that none of this ever happened, if India felt insecure, it would still produce how much nuclear weapons it needs. It has sufficient domestic sources of uranium to expand its nuclear arsenal without the sale of uranium by outside sources. All of the NSG deal does is slow and prevent the civilian capacity from increasing. It's really you're scuppering one side of the program in order to maybe have some effect on the military program, but ultimately you can't stop India from expanding its military program if it wants to.
Stuart and then John.
Yes, Dr. Lee. What type of effect do you think India's relationship with the NPT would have on India securing a permanent seat in the United Nations?
Well, it's interesting that I think because of the NSG waiver, I think there's effectively a de facto acceptance of India as a nuclear weapons state. So because this NSG waiver has been passed, I think actually India's chances of being accepted, if there was a reform of the Security Council, which is a big if, I think we've been talking about reform of the Security Council for 20-odd years or more. But I think India actually has greater chances now because of this NSG waiver. It's a demonstration that the world accepts that it's not going to give up its nuclear capabilities.
John, why did China agree to the NSG waiver?
Well, I'd say that's an interesting question, one that I asked as well, because it seemed a bit counterintuitive that China, as a member of the NSG, would allow it. China is very good in its diplomacy of not being too loud if it objects to something. It will try and do it very quietly, bilaterally. And what happened essentially is that it was outmaneuvered in the nuclear suppliers group. There were a group of about five or six states that were concerned about the deal and the non-proliferation effects of the deal. And one by one, they were convinced of the idea that we weren't going to be able to reverse India's policy. It was a responsible nuclear state, and that essentially we should trade with it. Now, one by one, these states folded, and China didn't want to be left alone as the sole holdout, preventing India from effectively being brought within the non-proliferation regime. So from those grounds, I think China doesn't ever want to be seen as, well, if you think of it in the long term, they don't want to be seen to be holding back the other great rising power in Asia. And China, in a way, has a lot of... both China and India have good reasons to not want to have their conflict become too overt, in that they both are developing countries and they both really need to focus on development rather than antagonising their military relationship.
Down the back, yes.
Dr.
Lee,
have you come across any evidence of support from South Australia or from the Territory
Question about support from South Australia or the Northern Territory for the policy you're suggesting?
As opposed to opposition from the New South Wales government, which works a great deal with mining royalties.
I must say, I can't answer that question. I haven't really looked into the domestic support for it.
I think the answer is that the South Australian government is opposed to the export.
Only because Labor.
Well, there's strong opposition in the Labor left
to changing
the policy. I mean, the Labor left agreed to open additional mines, and that was the end of the compromise. The Labor left never agreed to export to a country which hadn't signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And
you can't change it a little.
Well, that's a good point. Just what did the Howard government do, or say that it might do, towards the end of the Howard administration?
Well, pretty much they wanted to reverse the policy. They announced, I think, in the closing months of the Howard government's tenure, that Australia should sell uranium to India and put forward a bilateral safeguards agreement with India requiring it to separate its civilian and military program and put those under IAEA safeguards. And under the Howard government, I guess we all know that the Howard government was much more aligned with the United States foreign policy, which the US has essentially views India as the new rising power in South Asia, that it could be a strategic partner because they both have interests not so much in containing China. It's not about a containment policy, but it's a kind of a hedging policy that we don't know what China's intentions might be as it rises. So it's a good thing to ally yourself or to develop a stronger military and economic relationship with a rising power that is democratic and shares your interests. So they accelerated more, I guess, military exercises like the Malabar exercises in 2007. And if they were in power again, I think they would be accelerating even further in that direction.
Right, so right... Oh, well, we had that...
Hello?
Yeah.
Do Indians believe that Australia is sort of dealing this way because they don't want to offend China, or they want to keep sweet with China, or they're a big economic force in Australia, and also we don't want to offend Pakistan because, in fact, we are involved in Afghanistan on a similar campaign or some sense.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that's always part of the equation, but given that the NSG has given a waiver, I don't think Australia would therefore be singled out as giving India any special favour that other countries can't also give to it. So I think in that sense, those fears about what China will think will be less important, because really I think the world will just think Australia is just doing what everybody else is doing. And India and China itself have been getting... I guess developing closer relations, and there's even talk of the two of them signing some kind of cooperation in civilian technology, which might surprise you.
What about Pakistan?
In terms of offending Pakistan, I think actually the reason Australia's policy hasn't changed is what Jared was saying. It's more not so much about the international perspective, but as in effects on that regional dynamic. It's more about Labour Party policy in terms of supporting the non-proliferation treaty.
Yes, I fail to agree with the argument that India needs nuclear weapons in order to be protected against neighbours who have nuclear weapons. Look at Japan. They have got every bit as much reason to fear China as India would have. Japan doesn't have nuclear arms. Look at Germany. They've been surrounded by countries who have nuclear weapons. Of course, for historical reasons, neither of these countries were allowed to have nuclear arms, but they have done well not having them,
yeah.
And I think they have not been any less secure. And
well,
as far as joining a non-nuclear proliferation treaty is concerned, your argument for Australia selling uranium to India is mainly a pragmatic one. Couldn't India, for pragmatic reasons, join the non-nuclear proliferation treaty?
Okay, well, first I'd say that Japan and India are very different. Japan is essentially covered by an American nuclear umbrella, and just as Germany was covered by an American nuclear umbrella during the Cold War, so they didn't really need their own nuclear arsenal to protect themselves. If you look at the history of India's development of a nuclear weapons program, they initially started an energy program from the time of independence, from around 1947. They were already worried about energy security from that point. And it wasn't until really the main instigator was the 1962 border war between China and India. And in 1964, China developed nuclear weapons and had its first nuclear test. So India did try to get the USSR or the United States to cover them with their nuclear umbrella, but it didn't happen, and it wasn't forthcoming. So they felt like they had to protect themselves. There were no other options. So I think they're very different cases. To India and Japan and Germany are very different cases. In terms of joining the NPT, I really do think it's part of this debate as that. Even President Obama is now going down the path of nuclear disarmament. It all comes down to will all of the nuclear weapon states agree to reduce their arsenals? India will not alone agree to destroy its nuclear capabilities. If its neighbours don't destroy its capabilities, it's just, I think, a logical thing. And until all of these states agree that having nuclear weapons is not a good thing, and that they all agree to start working towards zero, I don't think it's actually reasonable for India to also take the first step and unilaterally destroy its arsenal.
Now, getting close to the end, so I think it's the final question down the back.
This is Dr. Lee.
Yeah.
I don't know, I can't recall when Pakistan was that last year.
Oh, wow. I don't know the date. I think it's quite a long time ago, though.
The question is that we know that Iran is possibly quite close down the track. We know North Korea is probably up there as well. And no doubt the dynamic that we need is that more countries will go down that path. Do you think there's going to be some need of game change at the UN level where we need to have a complete revisit of what it means for a non-nuclear treaty?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think there's some good first steps. In the last review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, one of the main impediments was the fact that the nuclear weapon states themselves have never taken adequate steps under the treaty they're meant to have to reduce their own arsenal. So it was really the non-nuclear weapon states were saying, well, you're focusing so much on us, on us not developing nuclear weapons ourselves, yet you show no real commitment to reducing your arsenal. So while there's that imbalance, you're just picking on one side, and it's an unfair kind of bargain. So it seems the way that I think the review conference is going to go is more commitments about disarmament. I think that's important for the nuclear weapon states to do that, to take that first step. But I think there'll also be more movements to do with things like freezing the present competition. So getting states to agree to sign on to a fissile material cutoff treaty and also a comprehensive test ban treaty. And if you can start with that, I don't think there's any plans to scupper the whole treaty itself, but it's these small incremental steps that are on the way. And the other factor I would say is a push to stop or to prevent non-nuclear weapon states from accessing enrichment and reprocessing technologies, because there's not really a great deal of difference between a civilian enrichment capacity and a military program, as you can see with Iran.
Just one final point. Most of the questions have been on security issues, but you also mentioned climate change in your speech. To what extent do you think that the attitudes to India might change because of the climate change debate and the collapse of the Copenhagen conference? If Australia really wanted to make a contribution to reducing carbon emissions, the easiest and the cheapest, well, we'd actually benefit from selling uranium to India for energy purposes. Do you think that debate's going to come forward in Australia and the United States? It probably has already in Canada.
I actually think that might be a way out for the Labor Party in terms of being, you know, it's hard to abandon a policy that your core constituency or the left holds on to dearly, but the left also holds on to this problem of climate change mitigation. And I'd agree with you completely that, you know, these are the two major countries that are going to grow to a huge extent in the next 50 years. And nuclear power is the technology that we have now today that can make a difference. And I think there is a move towards more practical steps, more bilateral steps, as opposed to multilateral agreements that we've already seen are so difficult to agree on.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
All right.
Many thanks to Dr. Lee. This is a big topic. People are interested in climate change. People are interested in the Australia-India relationship, which has come a long way over the last 20 or so years. And it's important that Dr. Lee at Macquarie University is working on these topics, writing on these topics, and coming along to the Sydney Institute to talk about this topic. This is one of her specialities. So for tonight, thanks for making an important contribution to the debate. Maybe we'll have you back sometime to talk about your other area of study, which is US policy. But for tonight, on the issue of Australia, India and uranium sales, many thanks for a fine presentation. And your paper will be up on your paper will be published in due course, and the talk will be up on our podcast tomorrow. But for tonight, many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon. Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute this evening with our speaker, Dr. Lavina Lee. I'll introduce her briefly. She worked in consultancy. She did a research work at the Chatham House in London, and she's currently lecturer in politics and international relations at Macquarie University. In recent times, she has a grant from Macquarie University to study the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement and its relationship to Australia, and in recent times she's just published a book with Routage titled US Hegemony and Legitimacy, Norms, Power and Followership in the War in Iraq. If you want a copy, Anne can give you information.
It's expensive.
What it really should be called is U.S. policy in Iraq, I think, is the non-academic way of saying it. And Dr. Lee is going to speak for us tonight on her speciality, or one of her specialities, which is why Australia should sell uranium to India. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Jared and Anne for the opportunity to speak here at the Sydney Institute. Now, tonight I'm going to be speaking about what I believe to be a central issue holding back a deepening of the strategic and economic relationship between Australia and India. The decision, basically, by the Rudd government in January of 2008 to reverse the Howard government's recent policy towards the end of its tenure, to begin selling uranium to India. Now, I must say at the outset, it's not my intention at all to speak about whether Australia itself should have a nuclear power generating capacity. That's not my interest tonight. It's purely about the Australia-India relationship. Now, Australia is a country with abundant natural resources in uranium. According to the World Nuclear Association, in 2007, Australia had the world's largest known deposits of low-cost uranium, with about 23% of the world's low-cost uranium, followed by Kazakhstan and Russia, who had 15% and 10%, respectively. Now, we've been exporting uranium for some time to both recognised nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, with our major buyers being the United States, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and more recently China from 2006 onwards. In the year 2008 to 2009, around 10,000 tonnes of uranium oxide concentrate were exported with a value of about $1 billion Australian dollars. In terms of Australia's uranium export policy, the Labor Party has long been guided in its uranium export policy by concerns about the proliferation of nuclear weapons technology. When in power, it has taken an active role in international diplomacy over the development of things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty, the establishment of the Canberra Commission, and the creation of the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, which is co-chaired by Australia and Japan. Now, whilst the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have in the past disagreed about how many uranium mines Australia should have and how much uranium we should export, both parties have been in agreement about the need to ensure that Australian uranium ore, if it's exported, is only used for peaceful purposes. With this in mind, Australia's uranium export policy therefore includes the following conditions. One, that uranium may only be exported for peaceful non-explosive purposes under a network of bilateral safeguards agreements, which provide for, I quote, coverage of uranium exports by IAEA safeguards from the time they leave Australian ownership and continuation of coverage by IAEA safeguards for the full life of that material or until it is legitimately removed from safeguards. Further, Australia will not export uranium to any country that is not a party of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And any customer that is a non-nuclear weapon state must have also concluded a full-scope safeguards agreement with the IAEA, including the signing of an additional protocol. Under these conditions, the sale of uranium to India is precluded because it is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, since the Rudd government made the announcement about its change of policy on India, on the sale of uranium to India, there's been two major developments that have taken place. Firstly, the approval by the US Congress of a bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement between the United States and India in October of 2008. And secondly, the issue of a waiver by the Nuclear Suppliers Group allowing trade in civilian technologies and materials by its members with India on the 6th of September 2008. It should be noted that the Nuclear Suppliers Group is a consensus body and that Australia, as a part of the NSG, also agreed to the granting of this waiver to India. As such, the NSG effectively agreed to recognise India's status as a de facto nuclear weapons state. Now, despite its support for the waiver to India at the NSG, on his visit to India in November 2009, Prime Minister Rudd reiterated government policy to bar uranium exports to that country. At the same time, he acknowledged, I quote, India is a fundamentally important relationship for Australia. It is so strategically, it is so economically. Now, Mr. Rudd noted that in past decades, the relationship with India had been on again and off again and hopes to rectify that situation. Now, what I'm about to argue is that Australia's stance on exports of uranium to India is now an outdated policy. It serves no real non-proliferation purpose. It is counterproductive to our stated climate change mitigation aims, and it stands in the way of real recognition of India's importance to Australia strategically and economically, and therefore it should be reversed. Now, firstly, I argue that the Labor Party's policy on uranium sales to India is now out of step with outside events and serves no further non-proliferation purpose. Now, as a result of the two events I've just mentioned, the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement and the NSG waiver, India is now viewed as a de facto nuclear weapon state, despite not having joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. By refusing to sell uranium to India, Australia now stands alone in pursuing an outdated strategy to bring India into the NPT. And I'd like to briefly just talk about what that previous strategy was. The non-proliferation regime has long followed a policy of isolation in regard to those states that have remained outside the NPT, that have refused to join it, including India, Pakistan, and now North Korea. Since its first peaceful nuclear explosion in 1974, India has been unable to access nuclear technology and materials through trade. The NSG itself was created at the instigation of the United States as a response to these 1974 peaceful nuclear explosions, to coordinate export controls on nuclear trade to prevent transfers of civilian nuclear technology and material from being diverted to military purposes. India has never joined the NPT on the grounds that it is an inherently discriminatory regime that does not compel nuclear weapon states to disarm, whilst requiring non-nuclear weapon states from seeking their own weapons capabilities. Now, whilst India is not a nuclear weapon state or a non-nuclear weapon state, as it is not, it has never joined the NPT, the NSG barred civilian trade with it and all other states that were non-party to that treaty, the NPT, on the grounds that, I quote, non-parties should not be given the same assistance as those that had joined the treaty. That is, the non-proliferation regime sought to isolate those countries outside the NPT from nuclear trade to provide them with an essential incentive to join and to reward those non-nuclear weapon states within the treaty for their nuclear abstinence. Now, despite this strategy of isolation, during this period, India has developed a truly indigenous nuclear program, both in a civilian and a military capacity. This includes a fleet of advanced heavy water pressurized reactors, as well as a reprocessing and enrichment capability. This has largely come about for two main imperatives. One, a desire for greater energy security through nuclear power, as well as for military security as a defence against nuclear coercion from its neighbours, Pakistan and China, with whom it has fought previous military conflicts in the past. The US-India agreement and the NSG waiver represents an abandonment of the strategy of isolation against India and an acceptance of the fact that India will never sign the NPT if it first requires the destruction of its nuclear arsenal. India's strategic insecurities essentially preclude it from doing so without the disarmament at the same time of its neighbours, Pakistan and China. Now, the abandonment of this strategy by the NSG stems from the view that more can be achieved by bringing India into the wider non-proliferation regime by requiring it to abide by things like NSG export controls and missile technology control regime guidelines, by requiring it to separate its civilian and military nuclear programs and to place the former under IAEA safeguards, which it has agreed to do. By sticking to a policy based on an outdated state of affairs, despite supporting the NSG waiver, the Australian government cannot alone achieve any non-proliferation benefits. India is now free to trade in civilian nuclear technologies and materials with any other NSG member. Now, I'd like to also argue that the sale of uranium to India would support the non-proliferation treaty rather than undermine it. It has been argued by the arms control community that the NSG waiver rewards India for staying outside the non-proliferation treaty and developing a military program. They argue that the lesson that may be learned from the Indian case is that ultimately there are no consequences for the development of a nuclear weapons program, which, once acquired, is considered a fact that the international community has no choice but to accept. This, they argue, may encourage other non-nuclear weapon states to withdraw from the treaty. Now, what I argue is that the sale of uranium should not be viewed as, in fact, rewarding India for staying outside the nuclear weapons, the non-proliferation treaty. Rather, it should be seen as a reward for showing restraint in its nuclear policies and for its adherence to non-proliferation norms, despite not being a member of the NPT. India can be regarded as a responsible nuclear power because it has never spread its homegrown nuclear weapons technology to any other state, unlike China, who is a member of the NPT and has been linked to proliferation to Pakistan. It has maintained a voluntary moratorium on nuclear testing since 1998. It has declared no first use policy in regards to its nuclear arsenal, and it has a minimum credible deterrent policy in regard to the size of this arsenal. For these reasons, it should not be put in the same deviant category as other non-nuclear proliferation treaty states such as North Korea and Pakistan. The NSG has also agreed to consult on the issue of a withdrawal of the waiver should India conduct a nuclear weapons test again. As a result, the Indian government would have a strong interest in abstaining from testing again to avoid jeopardising its access to international trade in civilian nuclear technologies and material, both of which is necessary to underpin its stated ambition to expand this nuclear power capacity exponentially. I would like to also now briefly address the argument that the sale of uranium to India would indirectly allow its reserve of its domestic uranium resources to be reserved for its military program. Now, this is technically possible. Whilst India was subject to NSG controls, that is prior to 2008, both its civilian and military program were restricted by the limitations of its natural uranium ore reserves, which are small and of poor quality. India, as a result of the NSG agreement and the US-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, has agreed to separate its civilian and military programs, but it has not agreed to cap its fissile material production. So technically it is possible for India to reserve its domestic sources of uranium for its military program. Now, one, I would say, however, that from Australia's point of view, the same objections would apply to our uranium sales to China. There is no, at this stage, no agreed fissile material cut-off treaty. In my view, in assessing the likelihood of India now accelerating its military program and the size of its strategic arsenal, we should keep in mind its past policies of nuclear restraint. There has been no change to its policy of seeking a minimum credible deterrent, which is estimated to fall somewhere between 100 and 150 nuclear warheads at most. It does not seek parity with China, which has about 400 nuclear warheads. It only needs to ensure that it has a sufficient number of nuclear warheads and adequate delivery systems to ensure a second strike capability. Economically also, India is still far behind China in terms of the size of its economy, and it cannot compete in a nuclear arms race from that basis. The problems of poverty alleviation and economic growth are of much greater priority. Now, if there are no longer any non-proliferation benefits to be had by refusing to sell uranium to India, then I argue that Australia is unnecessarily missing out on a number of economic, climate change mitigation, and strategic benefits that could arise from a reversal of this policy. Australia, in terms of economic benefits, Australia is unnecessarily missing out on economic opportunities that have arisen as a result of the NSG waiver. India has announced plans to exponentially expand the contribution of nuclear power to its energy mix. The government of India aims to continue a 8-9% growth target to bring greater numbers of its population out of poverty. In 2006, the Indian Planning Commission estimated, I quote, "With the population growing at 1.5% per annum, 9% growth in GDP would double real per capita income in 10 years. So from the Indian government's perspective, it is essential to maintain this 8-9% level of economic growth. India still has a significant proportion of its population living in poverty, with around 28% of the rural population and 26% of the urban population still living below the poverty line. There is also a strong connection between economic growth and energy security. The Indian Planning Commission has estimated that to sustain an 8% growth rate up to 2031 to 2032, the country needs to expand its electricity capacity by 5 times over the next 20 years. Now, in order to achieve this target, the government plans a massive expansion of nuclear power. There are varying estimates on the size of the growth of this growth, with one report stating that the government plans to expand nuclear power capacity from around 4,000 megawatts to around 50,000 megawatts by 2040, whilst another report cites a statement by Sri Kumar Banerjee, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, as estimating that nuclear power generation will increase to 60,000 megawatts by 2035. So that's a real massive expansion in nuclear power. Now, India does not have sufficient indigenous sources of uranium to fuel this expansion, unless its ambitious fast breeder program is successful. The Department of Atomic Energy has estimated that the indigenous uranium resources can sustain the production of 10,000 megawatts per year for 40 years, passed through pressurized heavy water reactors. If the fast breeder program fails to materialise, the expansion of nuclear power will require the import of a substantial amount of uranium. The reality is that if Australia continues to refuse to sell uranium to India, it will be able to meet its requirements through trade with other countries. States such as France, Russia and Kazakhstan have wasted no time in setting up deals to export nuclear reactors and material already. On the uranium front, while Australia has the largest uranium deposits in the world and the largest low-cost deposits of uranium, states such as Kazakhstan, Mongolia and Russia have already stepped in to fill the breach, while Canada is already keen to sign a nuclear cooperation agreement with India and is apparently in the closing stages of signing a deal. So as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this talk, Kazakhstan has the second largest low-cost reserves of uranium ore after Australia, and it has already signed a deal with India. Apart from the economic opportunities foregone, uranium sales will also support the Australian government's climate change objectives. It's well known that the economic growth of the two most populous nations in the world, China and India, into the next century will contribute to a vast increase in greenhouse gas emissions, unless there are significant breakthroughs in renewable and other clean technologies. Nuclear power is, of course, almost carbon neutral, emitting between 9 to 100 grams per kilowatt hour of carbon dioxide, compared to 800 to 860 grams per kilowatt hour from advanced coal. India cannot avoid using coal to fuel economic growth into the future, with coal being its most abundant natural resource. It has been estimated, for example, that India's consumption of the world's coal will rise from 6% to 45% by the middle of the this century. Nuclear power, however, can reduce the climate change impact of this growth by reducing the amount of coal used to provide electricity. In testimony given before the US Senate in 2006, the academic Professor David Victor estimated that the displacement of 20,000 megawatt E produced by coal-powered fire stations would abate around 145 million tonnes of CO2 per year. So if you remember what I said a little while ago, that India plans to expand its nuclear power capacity by about 40,000 megawatts. David Victor is saying 20,000 megawatts would abate around 145 million tonnes of CO2 per year. Now, he estimated that even a 20,000 megawatt E provided by nuclear power represented, I quote, the entire commitment of the 25 EU nations to reducing emissions under the Kyoto Protocol, and exceeds the total carbon savings from the 100 largest developing country projects under the Kyoto Protocol's Clean Development Mechanism. Now, if India manages to expand its nuclear power generation capacity to 40,000 megawatts, this would therefore abate around 390 million tonnes of CO2 per year. And to put this in context, for example, in Australia in 2006, our total carbon emissions were 417 metric tonnes of CO2. Now, lastly, I'd like to talk about the strategic benefits of changing this policy. I believe that the issue of uranium sales has become the central roadblock to a deepening of the strategic relationship between the two countries. Australia is very keen to build closer defence ties with New Delhi, a trend which began with the previous Howard government, with initiatives including Australia's participation, along with Japan and Singapore, in the Malabar naval exercises conducted by the US and Indian navies in the Bay of Bengal in September of 2007. Similarly, on his visit to India in October of 2009, Foreign Minister Stephen Smith put in a request with his counterpart, S.M. Krishna, to again participate in the Malabar exercises, and also invited India to participate in multilateral Australian Defence Force-hosted exercises in Kakadu and Pitch Black. To my knowledge, India has not yet acceded to this request. Both Australia and India share security interests in maintaining maritime security in the Indian Ocean and share an apprehension about the implications of a rising China. Australia's recent defence white paper makes clear that China's rising power, its military modernisation and projection capabilities have an unknown strategic purpose. It is Australia and India's interests. It is in Australia and India's interest to expand our naval cooperation in the Indian Ocean to provide a check on possible Chinese ambitions there. Whilst there are signs that both countries recognise their similar strategic interests, particularly the issue of the Australia-India, particularly in relation to the issue of a India-Australia joint declaration on security cooperation in November 2009, which includes defence cooperation on issues like terrorism and maritime and aviation security. This initiative so far, in its early days, has not been fleshed out. It is likely that whilst the uranium issue remains outstanding, genuine strategic cooperation will not be forthcoming. The Indian government will likely come under strong pressure from its strategic elites to slow progress on this front until the matter is resolved. From an Indian perspective, the refusal to sell uranium demonstrates a lack of trust in India's own strategic ambitions within the region. Thank you.
Many thanks. Now, as was pointed out, if anyone wants a copy of U.S. Hegemony, Legitimacy, Norms, Power and Fellowship in the War on Iraq, let us know, because we can get copies from the publisher and supply them to you. It's an important work and it's an important topic. So we now come to questions and discussion. Just to take on from where you finished your talk, when Ann and I were in India at the towards the end of 2008, talking to senior people in government, there seemed to be a great degree of intensity, a feeling about Australia's decision not to sell uranium. Do you pick that up in your visits to India, and what's the level of intensity?
Well, I was in India in October last year, 2009, and I spoke to probably about 15 or so people from the strategic community within India. And other than the issue of Indian students and racism in Australia, the second major issue was, why isn't Australia selling uranium to us? We don't understand it. Why is Australia the one lone holdout out of all of the other kind of possible strategic partners in the region? So particularly given that the NSG waiver has been granted and that India can in fact trade with any other country that it wants that has nuclear weapons technology and that's a member of the NSG. they can't understand why Australia won't abandon that. And I did pick up strongly that it seems like a nonsensical policy that they can't understand, and therefore they wonder whether then it's in India's own interest to progress a further strategic relationship with Australia, or a deeper one, in other words.
It's right, isn't it, that the non-proliferation treaty is due to be renegotiated soon. So could that present an opportunity for a change in India's status, and should Australia be taking it upon itself to lobby for a change, or could we have any influence in that process?
When you say a change in the status, what do you mean?
Could it be recognised under a new NPT as a nuclear weapons power?
I think
repeat that question.
Sure. I think, is it Anya? Yeah. Anya is asking whether there's a 2010 review conference for the Non-Proliferation Treaty this year, and Anya is asking whether this provides an opportunity for India to become accepted within the treaty as a nuclear weapons state. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Essentially? Look, I don't think that's a likely possibility. I don't think the members of the NPT don't want to make exceptions officially within the treaty itself. And they have pretty much stated that they will allow India to join the NPT only on the condition that it actually joins as a non-nuclear weapon state, not as a nuclear weapon state. And India will not give up its nuclear weapons. It has strong interests still in keeping its nuclear weapons arsenal for defensive purposes. So I guess the patch job that's been done, the NSG and the US-India Cooperation Agreement, is that we have to deal with the reality of India not joining the NPT, and because it has displayed responsible behaviour in the past, that it is, I guess, deserving of being treated as a nuclear weapon state without officially joining. Now, this doesn't mean that the international community isn't trying to draw India into non-proliferation norms. It's trying to encourage India, and India's quite receptive to the signing of a comprehensive test ban treaty and the fissile material cutoff treaty, for example. And India has also agreed to conform its missile technology controls and its non-proliferation export controls to accord with the same types of controls as other NSG members. Sorry, hope I've answered your question. Yeah.
Question here, then we go down the back. Yeah.
Tell me, why do people in India think that the Australian decision has something to do with not trusting India? Because the reason from an Australian perspective has nothing to do with India. It has everything to do with Australian support. We signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty under a coalition government and ratified it under a Labor government. It's been consensus politics in Australia for 40 years or more. And it has nothing to do with India. It's because of our very strong support for the non-proliferation regime and the feeling that the United States has all manner of weapons in its kit bag, diplomatically speaking. We only have one in this context, and that is our uranium, to try and strengthen, preserve, and if possible, grow the non-proliferation regime. This is the only card we've got to play, and we're playing it with everybody. If we only had an exception for India, what could we say to the Iranians and the North Koreans and others?
Well, look, first I'd say that Australia has agreed to sell uranium, for example, to China, and it does, from 2006. And yes, it is a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but you would also say that China doesn't in a lot of ways have as good a non-proliferation record as India does, even though India is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So in selling uranium to China, we don't require China to stop producing fissile material. So we put conditions on what the uranium that we sell them can be used for, but we don't preclude them from using their own uranium to reserve that for their military program and to build up their own strategic arsenal. So I think what India is saying is that you treat China in one way, and you treat us in another way because we don't sign the NPT. But India has never signed the NPT. It's not actually technically breaking any of its international agreements. It's never promised to make any of those agreements. So I think if you're looking at it from a purely what is the purpose of this policy, the purpose of the policy is to prevent proliferation, you've got to ask yourself the question, is it actually serving the purpose anymore? Now, in terms of North Korea, you mentioned North Korea. What does it say to countries like North Korea? I think what I argued in my talk was that what it's saying is that it's not rewarding India for staying outside the NPT. It's rewarding India for actually showing restraint in its nuclear policies over 30 years. It hasn't proliferated. It hasn't sought to expand its nuclear arsenal to a sizable extent. It has been very restrained. It has a no first use policy. It has a moratorium on testing. So it is a restrained nuclear power, and what these countries should learn from it is that if you similarly are responsible with nuclear technology, then you too could be rewarded.
As you know, Canada is an ally of Australia, so how's Canada getting around this problem?
Well, I think with Canada, Canada's taking the same pragmatic view as everybody else in the NSG, that India is a responsible power, and it's never going to sign the NPT. It too will have the same kind of safeguards as what Australia would like to apply. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we should treat India like any other nuclear weapon state that we trade uranium with. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a bilateral safeguards agreement, that we shouldn't have a strict separation between the civilian and military sides of their program, and ensure that only the uranium is only used in the civilian program. And we can do that. India, in its cooperation agreement with the United States, has agreed to separate between its civilian and military programs and to put the civilian program under IAEA safeguards and to assign an additional protocol. So we can be quite assured that any uranium that we send to India can be put under safeguards and be used only for the civilian program and not the military program.
There's a question right down the back. John, yes.
So I believe in your presentation, primarily followed a bilateral arrangement. I was wondering if your friends at New Delhi would have any problems if a Commonwealth colleague like Pakistan decided to go de facto with us as well. Would there be any negative energies concerned about
that? Look, I'd actually say that Pakistan has already tried to go down the India route. Pakistan has already requested the NSG to also grant it a waiver. And the NSG has refused it. And the NSG has refused it on the grounds that it has a poor non-proliferation record. So they can point to the AQ Khan network and the fact that Pakistan has proliferated to other so-called rogue states around the world. And it's very explicit about that, that it is about its record. And it's saying that India's waiver is granted because of its good record. So India, you know, India doesn't have to say very much because the rest of the NSG, I think, is in agreement that it's not necessarily a good idea to give the same kind of waiver to Pakistan.
So there's a question here, then we go down the back, yeah? I think I would go here and then to Gal. Yep.
As a geologist, I was interested in the uranium resource, but you answered the question, you know.
Yeah.
Because about 30 years ago, I just missed out on an exploration chart to do, to look for oil deposits in India. So I have a social political question. Here in Australia, you have groups opposing and using the phrase, you know, not in my backyard, when it comes to building electricity generation based on uranium. Do you have similar groups? Are they allowed in India to oppose energy, you know, based on uranium?
Okay. At the moment, there's a bill that's come before the parliament, or is going to be put before the parliament, about civil liability for nuclear accidents. Now, up till this point, there's been actually very little resistance within the Indian population to the government's expansion plans in nuclear power. I think that Indian people understand that if they're going to maintain an 8-9% growth rate, they have to expand their electricity capacity about 5 times. And if we've got climate change as a consideration as well, how is this going to occur? Up until this point, I think the middle classes in India have been very receptive to this idea that nuclear power could be the kind of silver bullet that will allow growth to continue and spread throughout the society. But I would say that in the next, say, 6 months, when this bill goes to Parliament, there are plans for nuclear activist groups to try and oppose the spread of this expansion, not so much on the basis that that they're against the expansion of electricity capacity, but they're worried about nuclear accidents and whether there will be sufficient monies reserved to compensate, because India was the site of one of the major disasters, the Bhopal incident, so there's a lot of concern about that.
Go up here.
This is really a follow-up question to the Pakistan question.
Yeah.
When you were talking about selling uranium to India and the impact that this would have on the flow-on effect on the possibility that India would use its uranium for military purposes.
Yep.
And we discussed this in terms of the strategic balance between India and China,
yep.
But didn't discuss this in terms of the strategic balance between India and Pakistan.
Yep.
So my question really is, if Australia were to sell uranium to India, if there were to be a strategic balance change between India and Pakistan as a result of that, and that's a big question anyway, but assuming that there would be a change, but then leaping into the importance, if you like, of nuclear power for electricity generation in India. Which is in Australia's greatest interest? To prevent any hypothetical change in balance between India and Pakistan, or to facilitate greater generation of electricity in India?
Okay, all right. I can kind of answer this in a few ways. Firstly, it doesn't really matter whether Australia sells uranium to India. From India's perspective, it can get it from somewhere else. So in that sense, Australia is denying itself some real economic and climate change benefits. The argument has been raised, I think I did speak a little bit about it, that with the NSG waiver, so let's take it away from Australia, with the NSG waiver, India can reserve its domestic sources of uranium purely for its weapons program. And there's nothing to stop it from doing that. It hasn't been asked to stop producing fissile material. Now, my response would be that it's always a possibility. It hasn't happened so far in the sense that India is making all the right statements about nuclear restraint, in that it is saying that it might seem odd to us from this perspective, but when you go to India, Indians seem to be much more worried about China and not so worried about Pakistan, even though we see more tensions with Pakistan than we ever see with China. So from India's perspective, India will always have an advantage over Pakistan, and in a sense it's an asymmetrical relationship between the three. Pakistan's never going to equalise with India. India will not be able to equalise with China. So potentially it could increase its nuclear arsenal, but from what it is saying is that it is showing restraint. It understands that there's a potential for causing other states to become alarmed if it does so. And I'd also say that even without this NSG waiver, say that none of this ever happened, if India felt insecure, it would still produce how much nuclear weapons it needs. It has sufficient domestic sources of uranium to expand its nuclear arsenal without the sale of uranium by outside sources. All of the NSG deal does is slow and prevent the civilian capacity from increasing. It's really you're scuppering one side of the program in order to maybe have some effect on the military program, but ultimately you can't stop India from expanding its military program if it wants to.
Stuart and then John.
Yes, Dr. Lee. What type of effect do you think India's relationship with the NPT would have on India securing a permanent seat in the United Nations?
Well, it's interesting that I think because of the NSG waiver, I think there's effectively a de facto acceptance of India as a nuclear weapons state. So because this NSG waiver has been passed, I think actually India's chances of being accepted, if there was a reform of the Security Council, which is a big if, I think we've been talking about reform of the Security Council for 20-odd years or more, but I think India actually has greater chances now because of this NSG waiver. It's a demonstration that the world accepts that it's not going to give up its nuclear capabilities.
John, why did China agree to the NSG waiver?
Well, I'd say that's an interesting question, one that I asked as well, because it seemed a bit counterintuitive that China, as a member of the NSG, would allow it. China is very good in its diplomacy of not being too loud if it objects to something. It will try and do it very quietly, bilaterally. And what happened essentially is that it was outmaneuvered in the nuclear suppliers group. There were a group of about five or six states that were concerned about the deal and the non-proliferation effects of the deal. And one by one, they were convinced of the idea that we weren't going to be able to reverse India's policy. It was a responsible nuclear state, and that essentially we should trade with it. Now, one by one, these states folded, and China didn't want to be left alone as the sole holdout, preventing India from effectively being brought within the non-proliferation regime. So from those grounds, I think China doesn't ever want to be seen as, well, if you think of it in the long term, they don't want to be seen to be holding back the other great rising power in Asia. And China, in a way, has a lot of... both China and India have good reasons to not want to have their conflict become too overt, in that they both are developing countries and they both really need to focus on development rather than antagonising their military relationship.
Down the back, yes.
Dr.
Lee,
have you come across any evidence of support from South Australia or the Northern Territory
Question about support from South Australia or the Northern Territory for the policy you're suggesting?
As opposed to opposition from the New South Wales government, which works a great deal with mining royalties.
I must say I can't answer that question. I haven't really looked into the domestic support for it.
I think the answer is that the South Australian government is opposed to the export.
Only because Labor.
Well, there's strong opposition in the Labor left
to changing
the policy. I mean, the Labor left agreed to open additional mines, and that was the end of the compromise. The Labor left never agreed to export to a country which hadn't signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And
you can't change it a little bit.
Well, that's a good point. Just what did the Howard government do, or say that it might do, towards the end of the Howard administration?
Well, pretty much they wanted to reverse the policy. They announced, I think, in the closing months of the Howard government's tenure, that Australia should sell uranium to India and put forward a bilateral safeguards agreement with India requiring it to separate its civilian and military program and put those under IAEA safeguards. And under the Howard government, I guess we all know that the Howard government was much more aligned with the United States foreign policy, which the US has essentially views India as the new rising power in South Asia, that it could be a strategic partner because they both have interests, not so much in containing China. It's not about a containment policy, but it's a kind of a hedging policy that we don't know what China's intentions might be as it rises. So it's a good thing to ally yourself or to develop a stronger military and economic relationship with a rising power that is democratic and shares your interests. So they accelerated more, I guess, military exercises like the Malabar exercises in 2007. And if they were in power again, I think they would be accelerating even further in that direction.
Right. So right. Oh, well, we've had that. Hillary?
Yeah. Do Indians believe that Australia is sort of dealing this way because they don't want to offend China, or they want to keep sweet with China, or they're a big economic force in Australia, and also we don't want to offend Pakistan because, in fact, we are involved in Afghanistan on a similar campaign or some sense.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's always part of the equation, but given that the NSG has given a waiver, I don't think Australia would therefore be singled out as giving India any special favour that other countries can't also give to it. So I think in that sense that those fears about what China will think will be less important, because really I think the world will just think Australia is just doing what everybody else is doing. And India and China itself have been getting, I guess, developing closer relations, and there's even talk of the two of them signing some kind of cooperation in civilian technology, which might surprise you.
What about Pakistan?
In terms of offending Pakistan? I think actually the reason Australia's policy hasn't changed is what Jared was saying. It's more, not so much about the international perspective, but as in effects on that regional dynamic. It's more about Labour Party policy in terms of supporting the non-proliferation treaty.
Yes, I fail to agree with the argument that India needs nuclear weapons in order to be protected against neighbours who have nuclear weapons. Look at Japan. They have got every bit as much reason to fear China as India would have. Japan doesn't have nuclear arms. Look at Germany. They've been surrounded by countries who have nuclear weapons. Of course, for historical reasons, neither of these countries were allowed to have nuclear arms, but they have done well not having them,
yeah.
And I think they have not been any less secure. And well, as far as joining a non-nuclear proliferation treaty is concerned, your argument for Australia selling uranium to India is mainly a pragmatic one. Couldn't India, for pragmatic reasons, join the non-nuclear proliferation treaty?
Okay, well, first I'd say that Japan and India are very different. Japan is essentially covered by an American nuclear umbrella, and just as Germany was covered by an American nuclear umbrella during the Cold War, so they didn't really need their own nuclear arsenal to protect themselves. If you look at the history of India's development of a nuclear weapons program, they initially started an energy program from the time of independence, from around 1947. They were already worried about energy security from that point. And it wasn't until really the main instigator was the 1962 border war between China and India. And in 1964, China developed nuclear weapons and had its first nuclear test. So India did try to get the USSR or the United States to cover them with their nuclear umbrella, but it didn't happen, and it wasn't forthcoming. So they felt like they had to protect themselves. There were no other options. So I think they're very different cases to India and Japan and Germany are very different cases. In terms of joining the NPT, I really do think it's part of this debate even President Obama is now going down the path of nuclear disarmament. It all comes down to will all of the nuclear weapon states agree to reduce their arsenals? India will not alone agree to destroy its nuclear capabilities. If its neighbours don't destroy its capabilities, it's just, I think, a logical thing. And until all of these states agree that having nuclear weapons is not a good thing, and that they all agree to start working towards zero, I don't think it's actually reasonable for India to also take the first step and unilaterally destroy its arsenal.
Now, very close to the end, so I think it's the final question down the back.
This is Dr. Lee.
Yeah.
I don't know, I can't recall when Pakistan was in the last few years.
Oh, wow. I don't know the date. I think it's quite a long time ago, though.
Question is that we know that Iran is possibly quite close down the track. We know North Korea is probably not there as well. And no doubt the dynamic of it is that more countries will go down that path. Do you think there's going to be some game change at the UN level where we need to have a complete revisit of what it means for a non-nuclear treaty?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think there's some good first steps. In the last review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, one of the main impediments was the fact that the nuclear weapon states themselves have never taken adequate steps under the treaty they're meant to have to reduce their own arsenal. So it was really... the non-nuclear weapon states were saying, well, you're focusing so much on us, on us not developing nuclear weapons ourselves, yet you show no real commitment to reducing your arsenal. So while there's that imbalance, you're just picking on one side and it's an unfair kind of bargain. So it seems the way that I think the review conference is going to go is more commitments about disarmament. I think that's important for the nuclear weapon states to do that, to take that first step. But I think there'll also be more movements to do with things like freezing the present competition. So getting states to agree to sign on to a fissile material cutoff treaty and also a comprehensive test ban treaty. And if you can start with that, I don't think there's any plans to scupper the whole treaty itself, but it's these small incremental steps that are on the way. And the other factor I would say is a push to stop or to prevent non-nuclear weapon states from accessing enrichment and reprocessing technologies, because there's not really a great deal of difference between a civilian enrichment capacity and a military program, as you can see with Iran.
Just one final point. Most of the questions have been on security issues, but you also mentioned climate change in your speech. To what extent do you think that the attitudes to India might change because of the climate change debate and the collapse of the Copenhagen conference? If Australia really wanted to make a contribution to reducing carbon emissions, the easiest and the cheapest, well, we'd actually benefit from selling uranium to India for energy purposes. Do you think that debate's going to come forward in Australia and the United States? It probably has already in Canada.
I actually think that might be a way out for the Labor Party in terms of being, you know, it's hard to abandon a policy that your core constituency or the left holds on to dearly, but the left also holds on to this problem of climate change mitigation. And I'd agree with you completely that, you know, these are the two major countries that are going to grow to a huge extent in the next 50 years. And nuclear power is the technology that we have now today that can make a difference. And I think there is a move towards more practical steps, more bilateral steps, as opposed to multilateral agreements that we've already seen are so difficult to agree on.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
All right.
Many thanks to Dr. Lee. This is a big topic. People are interested in climate change. People are interested in the Australia-India relationship, which has come a long way over the last 20 or so years. And it's important that Dr. Lee at Macquarie University is working on these topics, writing on these topics, and coming along to the Sydney Institute to talk about this topic. This is one of her specialities. So for tonight, thanks for making an important contribution to the debate. Maybe we'll have you back sometime to talk about your other area of study, which is US policy. But for tonight, on the issue of Australia, India and uranium sales, many thanks for a fine presentation. And your paper will be up on your paper will be published in due course, and the talk will be up on our podcast tomorrow. But for tonight, many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.